I woke early in South Bend and headed down to Indianapolis to campaign at an early voting site, hoping to catch the occasional voter near their county city building. It was humbling, a reminder that campaigning for office often resembles nothing so much as your first experience handing out flyers for something. In 2008, there would have been a line around the block as Obama drew record-breaking numbers of early voters. But this November morning in 2010 felt like the sorriest, quietest Monday that plaza had ever seen. A lone intern joined me, having driven me down from South Bend, holding a Meet Pete sign duct-taped to a stake as I looked vainly for someone to shake hands with. At one point, the police stopped by to make sure the two of us did not constitute an unauthorized demonstration. I perked up when one person came over and said he recognized me from my commercial, but then he explained that he was not able to vote because of his felony convictions. At one point, there was no one at all to talk to but a man walking up and down the block in a sandwich board from Paddy's Legal Beagle Pub, advertising a $5.99 lunch special, SPEACIL. Figuring he was a voter, I introduced myself, drawing breath and winding myself up for one more, "Hi, my name's Pete and I'm running for..." But he interrupted. "I'm not big on elections, I'm a monarchist myself." I must have stared dumbly at him for a minute, so he clarified that he was awaiting the King of Kings, and therefore not particularly interested in the democratic process. The road home went through Kokomo, and past those big Chrysler and Delphi plants one more time. I stopped at the ITP2 for a last round of handshakes with the UAW guys, before returning to headquarters in South Bend to work on two speeches, one for each outcome, and a bunch of thank you notes that I would need either way. At 7 in the evening, I excused myself to go to St. James for the All Saints Day service, then headed back to the office, where my next-door neighbors had dropped off sandwiches for me and the small team. Finally, there was nothing to do but go home and go to bed. At home, I asked myself in my journal, are we walking into a buzzsaw, or does a phenomenal surprise await? At least a buzzsaw is quick, but election day itself is torture for candidates. You've made the arguments, raised the money, and shaken the hands, and there's not much left to do but tell reporters you're confident of victory and go make phone calls or knock on doors like everyone else. Other than that, you were powerless. In Indiana, the polls close at 6 in the evening, a terrible policy when it comes to voter participation, but a small mercy for candidates who find election days interminable. It didn't take long after that for me to officially find out which one of my two prepared speeches I'd be giving. I'd worked harder on the concession speech anyway. By 8 p.m. it was clearly over, and I called my opponent to congratulate him. I offered my well wishes and anything I could do to help the state. Murdoch was gracious, and I was exhausted. Together with volunteers around the state, dedicated interns, and a paid staff that peaked at 3 people, we had treated this race as though it were the tightest and most closely watched campaign in the country. I had crisscrossed the state for months, generated almost exclusively positive press coverage, made friends in every corner of Indiana, and raised more money than any candidate for this office had in years. And yet we had finished with less than 40% of the vote. Technically, I can claim that I led the Democratic downstate ticket, since I got slightly more votes than my running mates for Secretary of State and State Auditor. But that did little to take the edge off the fact that the very first time I put my name on a ballot for office, fully 1 million people had voted for the other guy. Taking the stage at the Westside Democratic Club in South Bend, I faced a hall full of friendly faces, festooned with campaign signs and banners. It was my chance to thank supporters for everything they had done to help. I'd been clobbered, and so had many other Democratic candidates that night, but the atmosphere was far from grim. Joe Donnelly, our member of Congress, had managed to survive the Republican wave, one of a tiny handful of endangered congressional Democrats to get reelected that night. After congratulating Joe and talking to everyone who was at the watch party, there was suddenly nothing left to do. My team and I finished the night at Club 23, a dive bar named for its address on State Road 23. Unpretentious and friendly, it was the kind of place where your shoes would stick to the floor a little bit, a mostly dark and quiet space, brightened by the orange pleather chairs, the dartboard, the pool table, and a few neon signs. Behind the bar, Mo, yes, Mo, the owner and bartender, presided with a sharp gaze and a tight grin. I planted myself at a stool, trying not to look at the TV mounted off to the side where the local news was reviewing the election results. "How's it going?" Mo asked. "I lost." "I know," he answered, as he glanced at the TV and reached for the tap. Almost immediately after beating me, Murdoch got to work on his true objective, running for Senate in 2012. Using the treasurer's office as a platform, he challenged the Republican incumbent, Dick Lugar. Lugar, a towering statesman who had had the misfortune of announcing his candidacy for president in 1995 on the same morning as the Oklahoma City bombing, was a moderate, best known for brokering strategic nuclear arms reduction treaties with the post-Soviet countries in the aftermath of the Cold War. Helped by his far-right credentials and loyal Tea Party base, Murdoch won the primary, ending Lugar's 36 years of Senate service. In the general election, Murdoch faced Donnelly, who had entered the Senate race after his House district got redrawn unfavorably by the now very Republican state legislature. During the final debate in the last days of the election, Murdoch made another national splash, this time by saying he believed pregnancies resulting from rape were an expression of the will of God. An outcry followed, and national Republicans distanced themselves from him, allowing Donnelly to beat the odds and win the seat. We didn't know any of that would happen on that November night in 2010, but I did know better than to feel bitter or pessimistic. Buoyed by the support of friends and strangers, I had learned how to leave a comfortable world to take a big risk in defense of the people and ideas I cared about. Even in total defeat, I was proud of the campaign and the people who had been part of it. Old friends had dug deep to send donations. The 9 and 11-year-old children of the Montgomery County Party Chair had marched at my side in countless parades, distributing flyers and toting the Meet Pete sign, expecting no reward beyond a visit to Dairy Queen later. My neighbors in the Union Hall had become friends and allies. Everyone who had been involved became a new kind of community, one that I knew I would be able to turn to in the future. Most of all, I had received a priceless if humbling course of education, a fitting conclusion to a decade of learning. Chapter 6. A Fresh Start for South Bend. 10 weeks after my statewide political defeat, on January 21, 2011, Newsweek ran a story called America's Dying Cities. The authors analyzed demographic data, especially declines in the population of young people, to arrive at the conclusion that 10 communities in particular epitomized urban decay and were on their way out. Most were in the Midwest. South Bend was number 8. The short commentary concluded with this: what is particularly troubling for this small city is that the number of young people declined by 2.5% during the previous decade, casting further doubt on whether this city will ever be able to recover. I had just turned 29. South Bend reacted intensely. A Facebook thread from the time captured the range of opinion. "Doesn't surprise me a bit," one resident said, summing up a general pessimism among many who had seen employers, jobs, and stores disappear. "The demographic, the workforce, even the economy is all going downhill," said another. But in the comments and coverage of the time, you could also see the stirrings of a resistance to the doom and gloom narrative, especially among young people. On the same thread, a classmate of mine commented, "If you live here, quit complaining and do something to fix this town." Throughout the previous decade, the fate of South Bend had already been a constant topic whenever I was with people I had grown up with, inside or outside the city limits. Most of my friends had left if they had the opportunity, heading to Chicago, Indianapolis, or New York for a good job and a more appealing lifestyle, and those who stayed were restless. We would often gather over beer when we returned home for the holidays, swapping stories and news from mutual friends at Club 23 or the South Bend Chocolate Cafe. Inevitably, conversation would turn to the question of how South Bend could get moving again. What would it take for there to be more good jobs and more places to hang out here? Did a city like South Bend have a future? The sentiment wasn't just generational. Many people older than my parents sensed a need for our city to get its groove back with youthful leadership. "What our city suffers from is a lack of imagination," my mother would say from time to time. A retired business leader and a professor teamed up to put the sense of malaise into numbers, issuing a report called Benchmarking South Bend that showed numerically how South Bend was falling behind our peers on all the key economic measures that determined growth. In the business community, the discomfort showed signs of ripening into rebellion. As 2010 drew to a close and the 2011 mayoral election approached, there had been rumblings of recruiting someone to challenge the mayor, though it wasn't obvious who that challenger would be. One prominent attorney organized a major fundraiser for Henry Davis, Jr., an outspoken administration critic on the city council. It was a signal that Henry might be readying for a challenge to Mayor Steve Lickey from within the Democratic Party, but most doubted that he was ready for primetime. Others began to call me, but I was not inclined to blame the mayor for our city's problems, and I was already running for a different office, state treasurer. But the latter excuse died with my campaign on November 2, 2010, and then the conversations changed. In the first few days after I was defeated, there was plenty to think about besides my near-term professional future. I had a 1,000-page-high pile of thank-you letters to sign, a campaign headquarters to clean out, and a lot of grateful phone calls to make, not to mention a personal need to recover from the total exhaustion of a year's statewide campaigning. Running for a down-ticket statewide office entails the same geographic scope as running for governor or U.S. Senate, but with a tiny fraction of the resources. Joining the Navy Reserve had compelled me to get into the best physical shape of my life, and the campaign had still all but burned me out. But signing one thank you letter after the other, calling everyone who had lent a hand, and carting lawn signs and boxes out of the office was quicker work than I had thought. Even the sleep deficit didn't need long to take care of. And then there was the inescapable question of what to do next. It might be possible to go back to the firm, but I knew by then that consulting was not for me in the long run. I could try to take up active duty orders with the Navy, but I was still only an ensign in the reserve, relatively early in my training and unlikely to be found useful enough to deploy for at least a couple more years. Meanwhile, talk around town focused on a handful of prospective candidates for mayor, including me. The filing deadline wouldn't be for a couple of months, and so I didn't feel much pressure to look into it too quickly, until the doorbell rang one day while I was puttering around the messy domain of my dining room, sorting through piles of mail I had ignored while campaigning. I opened the door and stood on the porch, blinking for a moment, as I faced a TV camera and a local reporter clutching a wand microphone, wanting to know if I was planning to run. I don't remember exactly how I said no, but hopefully it was polite. In all honesty, it's not like it hadn't crossed my mind. I was one of those impatient millennial products of South Bend who cared about the city and wanted it to do more. But Mayor Lickey had not decided if he was going to run again, and while I shared the general sense of impatience, I was unsure how much of the city's malaise ought to be laid at his feet. In fact, I liked him a great deal. Tall, pastoral, and infinitely gentle, he had in his 15 years as mayor held the city together through a punishing recession, keeping its finances afloat even through state-mandated property tax cuts that had forced savage cuts in the local budget. Business leaders were impatient, but under the circumstances, any one of the developments that did take place was miraculous. At the very least, he had earned the opportunity to decide whether to seek another term before others came rushing onto the scene. Meanwhile, I wasn't just tired, I was also getting near the bottom of my savings account. I had health insurance and a little income from reserve duty, but that came to about $400 a month, just shy of enough to cover my mortgage. And half of that seemed to go to military expenses, like uniforms and gas money for getting to my monthly drill duty at Great Lakes, Illinois. Another campaign would wipe out what cash I had left and leave me reliant on credit card debt to keep going. But I also felt strongly about how the city could be run differently. Well-trained at the firm in performance management and economic development, I could envision an administration that ran on business principles without abandoning its public character. I felt that I understood our city's problems, not just as a resident, but also as a professional. The overlap and balkanization of our city's economic development efforts reminded me of what I had seen on my trips to Afghanistan as a consultant dealing with the bewildering array of development agencies on the ground there. I couldn't yet picture myself as mayor, but I could picture how the city might run differently if I were in charge. Meanwhile, people I respected wanted me to look at it, and not just young people. It was one thing for a high school friend to prod me about it over a beer, though some of them, like Mike Schmuel, had become accomplished political staffers and their words carried weight. But there were also people who had noticed me during my statewide run, people like John Stancati, a compact, energetic man old enough to be my grandfather, who had once run the South Bend Waterworks, and who asked me to get breakfast with him before I had even lost the treasurer race so he could urge me to run. I'd have thought the old-timers would be content to work through the party machinery, but they seemed as eager as the rest of us to see something completely different. So I became a regular at the Main Street Coffee House, a drafty corner hangout where I could ask different figures around the community what they thought, one cup of coffee at a time. In between camped-out students and business people having meetings, I sat listening to anyone who would give me time, the Redevelopment Commission president, the head of the local community foundation, the most respected black pastors on the West Side, to see what they thought of the city's future, and to gauge what they might think of me. I sought out former mayor and governor Joe Kernan, who still lived in town and had taken a liking to me during my doomed run for treasurer, perhaps out of affection for me as a fellow Navy man. If I were a serious contender for a job like mayor, I should be able to look a former mayor in the eye and tell him I was thinking about it. And his reaction would tell me a lot about whether my candidacy might be taken seriously. I asked him to lunch, and he agreed to meet me at Joe's Tavern, a smoky neighborhood dive bar on the west side, not far from the minor league baseball stadium. Governor Kernan is a picky eater. He likes green peppers on his pizza, but prefers to add them himself at the last minute, so their moisture doesn't make it soggy. "It droops, Pete," he once explained, holding up a slice to demonstrate, and staring intently yet warmly at me from under his thick white eyebrows. The governor also does not care for pumpkin, for the understandable reason that he ate little else during his 11 months as a POW in Vietnam. Now he was retired from politics, but his name was inseparable from South Bend. He'd been city controller, then got elected mayor in 1987, before being offered a slot as Frank O'Bannon's running mate when O'Bannon ran for governor in 1996. Loving the job of mayor, he first refused the offer, but then reluctantly accepted, and then won. In his second term as lieutenant governor, Joe faced a decision about whether to run for governor himself. He weighed the decision with friends, family, and allies before making his decision. He would not run. Party faithful were shocked, since he was expected to be a shoo-in for the nomination, if he wanted it. But he and his wife Maggie were ready to go back to life in South Bend. Throughout 2003, other candidates began preparing to run the following year, raising money and competing for endorsements. Then, a death changed his plans. While visiting a trade conference in Chicago in September of 2003, Governor Frank O'Bannon suffered a massive stroke and died a few days later. Unexpectedly and immediately, Kernan went from being a lieutenant governor, preparing to retire from politics, to a sitting governor called to lead the state in the wake of a tragedy. And serving as governor changed his outlook. It was no longer a decision about whether to compete for an open seat. It was a re-election, and he decided to run and seek a full term. But he had missed crucial time to build up a campaign organization, while the Republican Party had been rallying around Mitch Daniels, a former White House official and a senior executive at Eli Lilly and Company, perhaps the most influential firm in the state. Daniels defeated him soundly. Maybe this history explains why, after I worked up the nerve to ask him whether he thought it made sense for me to run for mayor, he stared at his basket of French fries in silence for several seconds before taking a breath and saying, "So much in politics is outside of your control." He didn't tell me I should or shouldn't, but described his love of the city and of the job. "In fact," he said, "it's the best job I ever had." That was impressive, coming from someone who not only had held the top job in state government, but also went on to live out the boyhood fantasy of being president of his hometown baseball team. After his defeat, Joe had organized the purchase and rescue of the floundering single-A South Bend Silverhawks and divided his time between presiding in a memorabilia-filled office at the stadium, teaching a course on leadership in a seminar room under the Golden Dome, and traveling the world with Maggie and his Notre Dame class of 68 golfing buddies. It seemed like a pretty good life to me. Yet even now, he looked on his days as mayor, not governor or lieutenant governor or baseball team owner or naval aviator, as the best job he'd ever had. Lunch by lunch, coffee by coffee, I gathered advice around town and began to realize that my own certainty about a run was growing. My friend, Mike Schmuel, architect of Joe Donnelly's unlikely 2010 re-election, promised to run my campaign if I decided to go for it, and many of the community leaders I respected most were offering not only to support me if I ran, but also to help raise enough money to get me started. All eyes were on the incumbent, the longest-serving mayor in history. Steve Lickey had taken over for Joe when he became lieutenant governor in 1997, and Joe himself had been our city's longest-ever-serving mayor at that time, which meant the city hadn't seen an open seat for mayor in 24 years. The small city rumor mill had Mayor Steve announcing his intentions by Thanksgiving, but the holiday came and went with no word. Finally, on December 8th, local TV stations showed him standing by the flags in the mayor's office, flanked by tearful staff, announcing that he would not seek another term. The seat was open. The race was on. By this point, there were two credible candidates in the Democratic primary, neither of whom was me. Easygoing and relatively young himself, Ryan Dvorak had been a state representative since 2002, when he was in his late 20s. His father, Mike Dvorak, had held the same state house seat for 16 years before Ryan, and was now the county prosecutor. The Dvoraks were almost a political party unto themselves, operating phone banks for fellow Democrats from a standalone headquarters separate from the party office. Thanks to his state house career, Ryan had the support of some labor groups and a healthy campaign account. Lobbyists with business in Indianapolis were reluctant to cross him, as were lawyers in the area who wanted to stay in his father's good graces. But many in the community were skeptical that he was the right choice for mayor. Some viewed him as a bit too partisan, while others remembered with displeasure his father's legislation to prevent South Bend from annexing the suburbs around it, a bill that was popular in the unincorporated community of Granger, but perceived as anti-city by South Bend residents. Awkwardly, Ryan lived on my block, and the back of his house faced that of my parents, so we crossed paths even more than normal as I explored a run. Ryan's rival for the nomination would be Mike Hammond. With salt-and-pepper hair combed in a sensible part, he looked like the coach and family man that he was. A well-liked teacher at St. Joe High, Mike had been county commissioner as a Republican, then switched to the Democratic Party, and was now on the county council. Like Ryan, he had the benefit of an enormous Catholic family, not only his own kids, but, by marriage, the well-liked Murphy family, which seemed to be one degree of separation from just about everyone in town. More conservative than Ryan, he was especially appreciated in pro-life Democratic circles, and he was the choice of the local Democratic Party chairman, Butch Morgan. Asked to describe his opinion of a troublesome politician, Butch once said, "If I ever write a book, he's going to be a chapter." Butch would rate his own political biography if someone wanted to write about how politics worked in South Bend when I was growing up. He once wielded influence in our county in the tradition of the urban Midwestern party boss, an enormous man with a baby face behind huge aviator glasses who more or less personally directed all aspects of the local party, except for the rebellious Dvorak wing, for years. From behind a desk heaped with walk sheets, clipboards, tote bags, chocolate wrappers, flyers, and campaign swag, he ran things mostly through the old touch-tone phone on his desk. If you went to see him in his office, he would receive and place several phone calls during the meeting without breaking his train of thought. If someone's name came up in conversation, he would call them on speakerphone for a 90-second conversation as if he were hollering to them in the next room. If his phone rang, he would take the call, give some instructions, hang up, and resume mid-sentence. An embodiment of the old school, he had lately taken to using email as well, but typed laboriously with one finger, this too in the middle of a conversation. He was known sometimes to sleep on a couch by the phone bank. Politics was his life. Butch was deeply religious, and had become a teetotaler at some point long before we met. "If I could get rid of three things in this world," he once said to me, "it would be alcohol, abortion, and racism." He specialized in retail politics, of the sort that had driven local office holders for years. Chicken and spaghetti dinners, lawn signs and nail files bearing candidates' names, parade entries, and puckish charm. His shtick on being introduced to someone for the first time had become a well-worn routine. You'd say, "Hi, I'm so-and-so, nice to meet you." Butch would say, "Do I owe you money?" No, you'd reply. "Then I'm very glad to meet you, too." When he showed up at an event, his face was usually obscured behind an enormous gift basket he was bearing from the South Bend Chocolate Company to be auctioned off or given out as a door prize. He was so unassuming, genially disheveled, and absorbed in old-fashioned retail politics that it was easy to underestimate him. But while closely managing the local politics around him, he seemed obsessed with getting the right candidate for County Council District H. He was also one of the most powerful figures on the Indiana State Central Committee, close with most of the state's top Democratic officials. Butch was also capable of various kinds of political mischief in order to get the outcomes he wanted. When a candidate named Sherry Schuster ran against Phil Dotson for county recorder without the blessing of the machine, Butch persuaded a loyal party volunteer with the surname of Schaefer to enter the race as well. She conducted no campaign activities, but the names were similar enough that voters were confused about whether they had meant to vote for Schaefer or Schuster, splitting Sherry's support and helping ensure victory for Phil. Butch had been very encouraging during my race for treasurer. But now, from behind his heaped desk, Butch affably made it clear that he was not going to support me for mayor if I got in. "I'm concerned about your age," he began, before ticking off a number of other reasons why he didn't think I was the right pick. And Butch had done his homework on the local landscape to see where I might get support. At one point, I mistakenly told him I had a shot at earning the backing of Carl King, the influential co-author of the Benchmarking South Bend study, whom I had come to think of as a mentor. Butch called Carl on the spot, on that indestructible speakerphone, and got Carl to make clear he was backing Hammond, while I looked on awkwardly. Not that I had expected Butch to weigh in for me. I had gone to see him more as a courtesy than as an attempt to win his support. But it was clear as I left headquarters that we would have to outmaneuver the party in order to win. At least I knew the Schuster-Schaefer trick wouldn't work on me. With a name like Buttigieg, I'd be hard to miss on the ballot. I figured the name might even help me. Needless to say, the Maltese vote was sparse. I knew of 4 total Maltese American voters in South Bend, including my dad and myself. But an unpronounceable, ethnically ambiguous name is practically an asset in northern Indiana politics. Depending on their own background, people could assume it was Hungarian, Polish, Serbian, Czech, or Belgian, all of which carried their own tribal loyalties in the area. The roster of local elected candidates around here is like a tour of Eastern Europe. Nizgotsky, Zakas, Kovach, Wesolowski. For every black German or Irish candidate with a name like Morton, Davis, Dieter, Bauer, or O'Brien, there was a Kupsch, Krasinski, Kostelny, or Grzegorek. Most illustrative of all was the former county councilman Randy Sheepish, P-R-Z-Y-B-Y-S-Z, spelled without the involvement of a single vowel. The stakes of running for mayor of my hometown would be a lot higher than they had been in a long-shot race for a state office few had heard of. Lose once in an uphill race your first time out of the gate, and you can still impress people by running respectably. Lose twice in less than a year, and you're probably done with politics, at least for a while. But this was home. I cared about this race even more than I had cared about Chrysler when I challenged Murdoch. The reason to run, the ideal reason to seek any job, was clear. The city's needs matched what I had to offer. The city was fearful of losing its educated youth, and I was a young person who had chosen to come home and could encourage others to do the same. Its politics were mired in the struggle between 2 factions of the Democratic Party, each with its own candidate in the race. I belonged to no faction, and could arrive without strings attached. And as the administration struggled to generate economic growth and maintain confidence in the business community, I had a professional background in economic development and was fluent in the language of business, even while having fought and bled politically for organized labor in the auto industry. This didn't just feel like an opportunity. It felt like a calling. It would come down to whether that match looked as clear to the voters as it did to me. Once again, I began to go through the motions of laying groundwork for a campaign. I enlisted Mike to organize a team, and he started recruiting local talent and colleagues from his last campaign. We got a booster of my potential run to donate some office space that he owned. I signed the paperwork to set up a new committee and bought a couple new dress shirts. On Saturday, January 29, 2011, about a week after that Newsweek article said South Bend was dying, I officially announced that I was a candidate for mayor. Saturday mornings in January in South Bend don't exactly invite you to leave the house, and my campaign staff of 3 was not sure how many people would materialize for our campaign announcement in the empty downtown storefront, next door to a small Thai restaurant that would be our headquarters. With neither the Dvorak family nor the local party organization behind us, it was vital that we pack the room in order to show this was kicking off as a serious campaign. Luckily, the phone calls and cups of coffee over the preceding weeks had paid off. By the time I took the podium, the windows facing Main Street were fogged up with the breath of over 100 supporters. Standing behind the podium in the better of the 2 suits I owned, I gave a speech that ran headlong into the issues surrounding the campaign. I opened by talking about that Dying Cities article, saying, "This is not an occasion for denial. It is a call to action." I took up the age issue, too, reminding the audience that our city was founded by a 33-year-old fur trader named Pierre Navarre, and that the University of Notre Dame was the creation of a 28-year-old frontier priest, Father Edward Sorin. I promised to grow jobs by simplifying business processes, to set up a 311 line for customer service, and to deal with the hundreds of boarded-up vacant homes in our neighborhoods. As soon as the speech was over, Volunteers settled into folding chairs at plastic tables to hit the phones, and I went out to trudge up snow-covered porch steps to knock on doors, just as we had in Iowa 3 years earlier. This time, the campaign was for the future of my hometown, and the name on the flyers and buttons was my own. One advantage of running for office statewide is that people generally understand you can't be everywhere. If someone invites you to a rubber chicken dinner in Terre Haute, and you've already promised to be at a fish fry in Evansville, then that's that. But in local politics, people know you're in town. If they invite you to a chili cook-off, and you choose to go to someone else's corn and sausage roast, they will find out whom you favored at their expense, and they will remember. And so we did our level best never to say no to an invitation or miss an event if possible, even if it meant arriving late or cutting out early to get to the next one. My record, set during Lent, was 4 church hall fish fries and a Polish dinner in less than 3 hours, including a few minutes' unscheduled pause to change clothes after a pierogi malfunction sent globs of cheese and cabbage onto the front of my blue shirt. Another feature of local politics is that there are a lot of people in charge of their particular spheres of influence, and it is important to pay them every courtesy. Some were very clear whom they were for or against. Others were more canny and subtle. James Harris Jr. presided over a shack of a liquor store in a lower-income neighborhood near campus, on land slated for a road to go through as part of a project backed by the university. A precinct chairman, he knew how everyone in his area was going to vote. With a stack of voter registration cards on the counter, he had personally registered any customer who stopped by from the neighborhood if they weren't voters already. Every once in a while, I would stop in to visit and try to see how he was leaning, but Mr. Harris remained permanently cryptic. I would lean over the counter as the occasional regular came in, usually for a 40 from one of his buzzing refrigerator units or a fifth of whiskey from off his plywood shelves. Under the fluorescent lights, Mr. Harris would hold court, unless his wife was minding the store for him. Getting up in years, he would look up past his glasses at me and smile a little mischievously, as if we were both in on the same joke, as I began our ritual conversation. "Hello, Mr. Harris, it's good to see you." "Well, I'd rather you be seeing me than viewing me." "Have you thought any more about the election?" "Oh, yes, I like what you're doing. I hear you're saying a lot of good things." "Does that mean I can count on your support?" "Now, I like the other guys, too, of course. All I know is I've got my store, got my wife, got my house. Notre Dame says they want my store, but what they really want is the dirt. Huh? Bullshit." If he was trying to get me to take a position on the upcoming road development, he never made it clear what question he was asking, or what answer he was hoping to hear. It was an infinite loop. We'd go around and around, and I never did get a clear expression of preference over whom he would back. But I'd like to think I won his vote in the end. In any case, Notre Dame must have paid handsomely for that shop with the house on top, because there's no trace of the liquor store, and yet whenever I see him in town these days, Mr. Harris is in a very good mood. Organized labor was divided. Many of the rank and file appreciated my stand for auto workers during the treasurer fight, but they also felt loyal to Dvorak because of his stances in the statehouse. I courted the ones that hadn't already promised to support him. The sheet metal workers came through quickly, and the firefighters signaled they were open to a conversation, so Mike and I, fresh-faced and clean-cut, went to meet them at their hall. Sitting with his fellow union officers at a big round table opposite Mike and me, Kenny Marks, the president, heard me out. A big man who was also a deacon at Mount Carmel, the fastest-growing black church in town, he leaned back in his seat and shifted between knowing glances at his fellow firefighters and piercing stares at us. He seemed interested but skeptical. "I like what I'm seeing, and I like what you're saying. But how do I know you're not just another sweet-talking devil trying to get my pants off?" It was hard to think of a good answer to that, so I kept on with the pitch. "I don't know about that, but you'll be able to hold me accountable for what we achieve from day one." You could never be sure, but I felt that our case was convincing, and that the groups we sat down with were responsive. Indeed, the firefighters Local 362 came through with an endorsement, complete with T-shirts. Then came the Chamber of Commerce, and eventually the South Bend Tribune. It was hard to tell if any of these would be decisive, but at the very least, they showed that our candidacy was serious. It was starting to feel like we had a real shot. And one day in March, as Mike and I walked out of a lunch event with Latino leaders, he looked at his phone, started grinning, and put his hand on my shoulder. "What? What happened?" I asked. "I got the poll. My friend, you're tied." Until then, we had no actual research showing we could win. But we had raised enough money to do a poll, and the poll showed me and Ryan each with about 30 points, Mike Hammond in low double digits. For reluctant supporters who said they liked me but weren't sure I could win, this could be the tipping point. In the detailed demographic crosstabs at the back of the book of results that came back from the pollsters, there was a curious detail. The older the voter was, the more likely he or she said it was a positive that I was 29 years old. To this day, I wonder why. Is it that senior voters are less likely to see distinctions between 20s, 30s, and 40s? Did I remind them of their children? Whatever the reason, we took the data as a reminder that you should never assume who will or won't support you. Soon, Dvorak released his own poll, saying he was ahead by 7. We knew we were competitive, but there was no infallible way to gauge where we stood, especially since an off-year race like this, with no federal or state elections sharing the ballot, would depend heavily not just on how residents felt, but on which campaign could turn out the most voters on Election Day. My two main rivals had been turning out voters in South Bend since I was a student. Our team would have to outwork and outwit them in order to succeed. The vibrancy of a campaign headquarters grows exponentially in the late weeks of a race. At first, there is nothing going on but a candidate fundraising and a staff member or two. The space is quiet, almost grotesquely empty, as its floor awaits tables, chairs, and volunteers. Then, imperceptibly, it begins to feel like a small community. Volunteers begin to populate the place, supporters drop off food, strangers pop in, and soon it is a hive of activity. Looking into the main room from the window of my small office, the tank as we called it, I watched the energy of my campaign change from that of a lonely project to something resembling a movement. By mid-April, there were a dozen staff members, mostly focused on organizing our volunteers. Racing to fund their paychecks, my call time intensified. Sitting across from Catherine Roos, a talented young architect fresh off a stint in London, I ground out hour after hour of calls. Catherine had expected to be home in South Bend only for a few weeks and was busy applying to graduate school, when a chance encounter in the soup aisle at Martin's with our mutual high school teacher, Mrs. Chismar, led her to a different path. Nearly all careers in campaigning and politics are either long-planned or unexpected, and hers was the latter. At Mrs. Chismar's urging, she had stopped by headquarters to introduce herself. A week later, she was the second full-time staff member of my campaign team, working as operations and finance director as the rest of the team grew around her, Mike, and me. Under her command, we raised over $300,000, enough not only to pay our staff, but also to launch a substantial mail and television ad campaign. One afternoon at headquarters, I plopped down at a desk, loosened my tie, and picked up a sheaf of papers, scrutinizing them intently, yet quickly, as a mayor would. Okay, that was good, but this time loosen your tie a little quicker. The whole scene's only going to be 3 seconds in the ad. Again. Okay, not bad. Try to look up a little more when you're looking at the papers. Again. Then the ice cream shop and the living room. The spot opened with a shot of me jogging in my neighborhood, and then had all the scenes you would expect in a campaign ad. Me with seniors, me with kids, me at a factory. But because this was local politics, I actually knew the seniors, the kids, and the factory, and voters would too. I thought it was a good commercial, and had raised enough funds to put it all over television for the final days of the race. But there was no way to be sure of its effect. A second poll wasn't in the budget. One evening, I was at my parents' house for a rare family meal, when I glanced at the muted television and saw myself, the same clip of me jogging that we had used, but in black and white. I grabbed the remote, turned it up, and heard the dark voiceover. What is 29-year-old Pete Buttigieg running from? Maybe it's the facts. The ad went on to say that I lacked, quote, the real experience for elected office, end quote. The ad had come from the Dvorak campaign. My mother was displeased, but I was delighted. Going negative on me was a clear sign that our competition was worried, and that I was now the candidate to beat. Back at headquarters, nervous volunteers asked how we would respond. By the standards of modern negative television advertising, it was pretty tame stuff. My campaign staff was almost gleeful that we were doing well enough to be worth attacking on television. It meant that our poll was not a fluke, though the ad might soften up our numbers if people found it convincing. But thanks to our poll, I knew what Ryan's team didn't. Reminding people of my age would only help. Rather than respond in kind, I decided to stick to our plan, focus on the economy, and stay positive. The penalty for negative advertising, I suspected, was greater in a local race where people know each other. In a community like ours, there might even be a political upside to the high road. Easter weekend came just 10 days before Election Day. I was sitting at a passion play at Washington High School when my campaign staffer, Isaac Goldberg, started looking anxiously at his phone in the seat next to me. He stepped out, then came back to his seat, looking shell-shocked, and whispered to me that Mike Hammond's wife had suddenly passed away. She was traveling with family in Paraguay and experienced a massive hemorrhage after a hike on Good Friday. So, as Easter approached and the campaign was in its final days, Mike and his family were left not only grieving, but having to figure out how to get her home to the United States. Hundreds of us packed the funeral at Holy Cross Church on the Near West Side. As at almost every Catholic funeral in South Bend, we sang from our hymnals the haunting refrain, "Shepherd me, O God, beyond my wants, beyond my fears, from death into life." People mingled after the service, exchanging words of admiration and appreciation for Mary's life and Mike's commitment to his family. The tragedy had achieved what might otherwise have been impossible. A gathering of hundreds of active community members just days before the election for mayor, with not a word spoken about the ups and downs of the campaign. With the heat of campaigning cut, at least for that one day, everyone could pause and remember that this was not a fight but a competition, among people who all wanted South Bend to be a good place to live in, for us and for those we loved. On Easter Monday, better known in South Bend as Dingus Day, the campaign had just 1 week to go. It is difficult to convey to an outsider the importance of Dingus Day, funny as it may sound. The holiday originated in Eastern Europe, where it was customary by the 13th century for boys to sneak into girls' homes at dawn and douse them with water as a sign of their affection. The girls would respond by giving the boys eggs and/or striking them with pussy willow branches. If you think this is absurd, envision what a European historian 800 years from now will think about photos of us celebrating the resurrection of Christ by placing terrified children on the laps of man-sized Easter bunnies in late 20th century American shopping malls. There's a lot more to the medieval East European tradition, but it's taken on a very American life in cities with large Polish and Hungarian populations, like Buffalo, Cleveland, and South Bend. The day has traditionally been marked with parties at union halls, social clubs, and bars, serving copious quantities of Polish sausage and beer. Since the early 1900s, this was also an irresistible occasion for meeting voters, and thus became a fixture on the calendar of retail politics in places like South Bend. When Bobby Kennedy came to South Bend for Dingus Day celebrations in the spring of 1968, it helped pave the way for the first primary victory of his presidential campaign, just a month before its tragic end. These days, Dingus Day for politicians begins before dawn, where we help, or attempt to help, boil sausage, noodles, and cabbage in the kitchen of the oldest and largest Polish-American establishment in town, the Westside Democratic and Civic Club. Local TV crews are there with live reports, and if the timing is right, they catch the arrival of several hundred pounds of kielbasa from Jaworski's Market. The most senior politician present, usually me or Senator Donnelly, has the honor of ceremonially signing for the sausage order. What follows is best described as a politics crawl, each location having its known slot on the rounds of the office seekers. There's breakfast at the UAW Hall, then a visit to the Crumstown Conservation Club, where beer is flowing and people are dancing the polka by about 9 in the morning. It is also customary to visit the African American Elks No. 235 Lodge on Western Avenue, where a Solidarity Day party is held that is just like Dingus Day, but with barbecued ribs and chicken taking the place of the kielbasa and kluski. Keep moving and eating, and by noon you're back at the West Side Club for the largest event, complete with a blessing from a Polish priest and some short speeches. Afternoon campaigning is not for the faint of heart. It's best to stick to churches and more senior-oriented clubs where the beer hasn't flowed quite as liberally. This year, Dingus Day fell just 1 week before the primary, and by lunchtime the West Side Club was packed. As the smell of sausages and cabbage wafted to the ceiling, the candidates made our final case. I talked about the need for a fresh start for the city. Ryan Dvorak stressed his experience. Mike Hammond, through a surrogate, thanked everyone for the support for his family and made clear he was still in the race. Barrett Berry, running a distant fourth, spoke of his South Bend roots and time as a staffer in the Clinton administration. The fifth candidate on the ballot had dropped out altogether. I voted before dawn, in a brightly lit lobby at the Notre Dame basketball stadium, the polling place for my neighborhood. Next came a ritual election day breakfast with my parents at Nick's patio and a visit to the grotto on campus to light a candle. What followed was as interminable as my last election day, but more excruciating because I felt this one was mine to lose. Once again, I had written two speeches, a concession and a victory speech. To blow off steam, I went to a park with my friend Nat, who flew in at the urging of my staff to keep me company and keep me sane, to toss a football around. In the sunlight outside Jefferson School, I did another round of interviews on how I felt confident but not complacent, and with nothing else to do as a candidate, headed back to headquarters to make campaign calls with the others. "Les agradezco de su voto," said Benito Salazar into the telephone, and moved on to the next name on his list. Cordell, our volunteer coordinator, checked on walkers headed to African-American neighborhoods on the west side, while my high school teachers, Mrs. Chismar and Mrs. Lightcap, sat at a folding table and called through the voter lists one last time. There were dozens of people helping to get out the vote. With every seat taken, my 66-year-old mother was sitting on the floor, a cell phone in one hand and pen in the other, marking down responses on a clipboard propped on her knees. People from every corner of my life filled the once-empty storefront. There was Jody Fried, the self-described universal Jewish mom of the campaign, next to a friend of mine from Harvard who'd come in to help for the final days. There were high school kids that our intern, Tyler, had recruited, next to neighborhood leaders and sheet metal workers. An elderly homeless veteran, whom we had nicknamed Jimmy Carter because of his resemblance to the former president, made calls next to a Notre Dame student taking a day off from class. "How's it look?" I asked one staff member or another every 10 minutes or so, peering over their shoulders in the boiler room at headquarters as they obsessively refreshed the spreadsheets on their laptops. Trackers at key precincts sent back reports on turnout, showing our strongest precincts coming in very strong. We wouldn't know how people voted until 6, but the places where I was most popular were voting off the charts. I retreated to my house by the time the polls closed, wanting to be out of the team's hair and needing a little quiet before preparing, win or lose, to face my supporters and the cameras. I climbed out through an attic window onto the small balcony overlooking the river and was watching its mesmerizing flow when the phone rang. Dvorak was politely conceding and pledging his help in the general election. Soon Hammond called to do the same. Mike drove me back to headquarters, and Catherine met us as we came in the back door. It felt as if everyone I had ever known was in there. It took about 15 minutes to get to the other corner, where a podium was set up for me to give a speech, working across the room in a blur of handshakes and hugs. We had won a majority in the 5-way race, decisively securing the party's nomination in our Democratic city. The Republicans had not found a strong nominee on their side. Indeed, many Republicans had crossed over to vote for me in the Democratic primary, knowing that a Democrat would likely win in November, and hoping that it could at least be someone with a business and military background. Almost certainly, this was the ballgame. In my speech, I thanked each staff member, down to the interns, and the campaign volunteers. I reminded them the real work was ahead, then insisted, as we had at the campaign's outset, that South Bend had everything we needed to succeed and grow. But I knew now that the challenge ahead would be different in nature. It was one thing to pull together a coalition for a campaign, another to keep a community unified through momentous changes. After the speech, as the applause grew to a roar, I turned to Mike. "Let's be sure to enjoy this. Pretty soon we'll have to start making decisions, so tonight may be the most popular we'll ever be." With most competitions, you sleep in after the big day and begin to recover your energies. But for political candidates, the day after a win at the polls usually starts even earlier than Election Day itself, making the rounds of the morning TV shows. Determined to cover all the local stations in the morning show window, I raced through the green rooms and studios of all four, in one case going on right after the puppies from the animal shelter. On television, you typically get 2 or 3 minutes to boil down whatever you have to say, and in my case, the hardest part was doing so while seeming lucid before dawn. It felt like one last challenge to cap off the months of phone calls, debates, and fundraisers. But I knew as I faced the studio lights and camera lenses that this was going to be the comparatively easy part. Going from campaigning to governing meant that there would be plenty of interest in what I had to say, but far more attention on what I was actually going to do. Section 4. Governing. When you were writing laws, you were testing words to find their utmost power. Like spells, they have to make things happen in the real world. And, like spells, they only work if people believe in them. Hilary Mantel. Chapter 7. Monday Morning. A Tour. Waking up comes hard. I've never been a morning person, and nothing can take the edge off a 5:30 cell phone alarm tunneling into the sweet haze of sleep. Strategically placed, the phone sits in the next room, so that I can't snooze or silence it without first getting out of bed. That 4-second long walk will bring just enough alertness to remember my promises. I must stay in motion, and not slide back into the warmth of my dreams. I try not to wake Chasten as I slip out from under the covers and walk to the small table where the phone sits. Truman is indifferent, curled up into a brown fur oval on a bench 2 feet from the bed. I lumber across the floorboards of the landing toward the bathroom to brush my teeth. The 1-inch white hexagonal tile, cold on my feet, is the same kind as in the 4-square house where I grew up, some 500 feet away. In the mirror, I make eye contact with an unshaven, bleary-eyed man in his mid-30s, looking harmless but not thrilled to see me at this hour. I'll just never be a morning person. If it were a Tuesday, I would have about half an hour to create the impression of being a morning person for the benefit of a local TV or radio audience. Though I'm hours away from my best level of functioning, coffee and professional necessity can make me just lucid enough to coherently answer the questions of the hosts on my near-weekly round of morning news appearances. It's one of my best opportunities to make the case for a new idea or make the public aware of a new development in the accelerating growth of our city. But this is Monday. No media today and no early event, which means it's a run day. It's cold out, but there's no ice on the ground. Ice will deter us, and sometimes rain gets us down, but if it's more than 0 degrees out and not slippery, then Joe and Tim and I can do our morning run. I pull on track pants over long underwear, a U.S. Navy hoodie over a long-sleeve t-shirt, and think about the saying I heard once during a delegation to Scandinavia. There is no such thing as bad weather, only bad clothing. It rhymes in Danish, ikke dårlig vejr, bare dårlig klær. In other words, put on enough layers and you'll be fine. Even the stairs are grouchy. They creak no matter how softly I tread. Everything in this 1905 house moves a bit, breathes a bit, especially in the wintertime. When I step out onto the porch to fetch the South Bend Tribune, I can see my breath, just as I could see it indoors when the real estate agent showed me the house in 2008. It had been vacant for nearly 2 years. Most of the pipes had burst, and an irregular chorus of low-battery beeps came from a half-dozen smoke detectors upstairs. The porch was in near collapse. Some of the small columns holding up the second-floor veranda were split in two, yet somehow still in place. Two big columns held up a small balcony outside the attic, one with a hole in its base so big you could put your hand through it. Carpenter ants and termites had undermined the pillars. Inside, every room had either cracked plaster or strange and peeling wallpaper, or both. Yet the house drew me in. There was a fireplace, not working, but salvageable. No one had painted most of the wood inside, including paneling in the hall. Its beauty was faded but not destroyed, and even the textures of its decay were appealing, like the irregular painted flooring of the small back porch. Every few days I'd check the asking price online and watch it dip by a few $1,000s each month as the bank that had foreclosed on it grew more realistic. Half a year after I first noticed it being advertised, it finally fell to where I could afford it. The mortgage, insurance, and taxes altogether would be about $800 a month, about half of the rent for my Chicago place and considerably less than I used to pay in Washington for a basement studio apartment accessible by a door facing an alley behind U Street. The house had good bones, as they say, and just needed a little work. Specifically, rebuilding the porch, tuck-pointing the chimneys, and replacing the broken pipes and collapsed floor in the bathroom. And then there was the rotted wooden framework holding up the third-floor balcony, and the small columns, and the bases of the big columns, and the wiring, and everything in the basement, which had flooded at some point during its vacant period, and the termite-ridden baseboards, and the unmoored light fixture dangling only by an electrical cord. Friends kept asking me if I had seen the film The Money Pit. It will never truly be finished, but we've got it looking good now. It's home. From the porch, I can see the lights of Memorial Hospital and the Chase Tower downtown, across the swift and steady river embanked alongside our street. The Tribune now in hand, I step back off the porch into the hall, stuff the paper into my briefcase, fold a suit over one arm, sling a gym bag over my shoulder, and try not to close the back door too loudly. I pull the back gate shut, step onto the concrete slab in the alley, and begin scraping the windshield of the Jeep. At 5:50, it is totally dark. But by now, both Joe and Tim have taken leave of their wives and children and are also headed toward the gym. They'll be ready to go at 6 o'clock sharp, and so will I. The Jeep warms up quickly. It's more car than I need, but the brutal winter of 2013, along with the transmission problem, motivated me to part ways with the old light green Taurus I'd bought when I moved home, known to interns and staff members as the Chick Magnet. The Jeep is better for transporting a bike, a visiting reporter, or a small contingent of staff. Its interior enjoyed 15 minutes of fame when Mark Zuckerberg visited South Bend for a mayoral tour and decided to go live from an iPhone mounted by suction cup to the dashboard, inviting in hundreds of thousands of viewers. And, crucially, it has seat warmers. The Jeep and I are nearly alone on the small bridge over the St. Joseph River, pulling up to a roundabout with "Welcome to South Bend" spread across it in big, illuminated white letters. This roundabout, and a second one afterward, are not the most popular thing I've done, but they've improved traffic flow and the look and feel of our entrance to downtown. Through the second one and down Main Street, I turn onto the cross street and pull into a parking garage. I drop my suit and car keys off in the locker and put on a hat and gloves. Tim will be waiting in the lobby of the gym, a carpeted area with a big screen TV where retirees sip coffee before or after their lengthy morning fitness routines, while young professionals and working mothers stride purposefully across the carpeted floor toward the aerobics classroom or the weight and treadmill area upstairs. Tim is a lawyer, formerly an accountant, taller and slightly older than me. Raised in Argus, about 45 minutes south of here in Marshall County, he is judicious and conservative, both politically and personally. The day I came out, via an op-ed that hit early in the morning, he was one of the first to text me something encouraging. Partly this was because he's a good friend and the kind of person to make sure to reach out, but it was also partly because his farm family upbringing never left him, which means he gets up ridiculously early and so was among the first to read the paper that day. Joe, by contrast, is nearly 10 years younger than I am, a college track team miler who had interned in my office during my first summer as mayor. He was one of a handful who had humored me by joining the early Wednesday morning outdoor workouts that I organized that summer for staff and interns during a particularly zealous and short-lived CrossFit phase. We'd go up to the track by the former St. Joe High School and flip 200-pound tractor tires that had been left there in the grass by the football team, do sets of push-ups between laps around the track, heave bags of water softener salt, and swing sledgehammers, that sort of thing. The interns called it CrossPete. The regimen didn't outlast the summer, but Joe and I kept in touch, and he took up running with Tim and me after he finished college in Fort Wayne and moved home. One reason we get along so well is the three of us don't talk too much. Chatting is optional, depending on collective mood and energy level. A companionable silence governs the first few minutes as our trio gathers by the mouth of the parking garage in our sweats and hoodies, and we trot, still in darkness, east on Jefferson across the two lanes, formerly four lanes, of Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard, formerly St. Joseph Street, and across the parking lot of the Century Center toward the sweep of the river. From the Jefferson Boulevard Bridge, you can see the man-made rapids in the river, and the river lights, a permanent legacy of our 2015 anniversary celebrations. We raised over $700,000 to have an artist install a dynamic light feature to illuminate the cascades of the river in sweeping and shifting colors. Rob Shakespeare and his wife, Marie, moved to South Bend and spent 3 months in town perfecting the design. The International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 153, volunteered the labor to set up the lights, some of which had to be mounted under the arches of the bridge. Like all good public art, the Bean in Chicago being the best example nearby, it has a charismatic quality that invites people to come up close to it and to mix with others not like them. On summer evenings, you will see clusters of people, clearly from different neighborhoods and lifestyles, walking in the park overlooking the cascades among lighted towers that respond to motion with patterns matching the lights on the water below. The colors of the light sculpture make up a universal language. Very different faces light up in the same way, responding to its hues when it surprises them with a burst of gold or pink. At this hour, no one is in the park to take in its kaleidoscopic glow, but we are treated to the red, then blue lights, striking the mist from the cascade and the fog from the comparatively warm river in the cold air as we continue east toward Howard Park. Careful not to slip on some remaining clumps of snow, we run, on tiptoe, down the concrete stairs connecting Jefferson above to the park below. The stairs bring us to a river walk, leading to a path originally built by the WPA during the Great Depression. Farther downstream, the river roils with eddies and whirlpools, but here above the cascade it is wide and slow, almost glassy in the morning dark.